Where were you on the morning of September 11th, 2001? What do you recall of that day? Who were you with? How did you learn about the terrorist strikes? How did you respond? What is your most searing memory? I'm your host, Dean Rotbart, with a special edition of Monday Morning Radio. This week, I'm pleased to offer listeners to this podcast an exclusive reading from my new book, due for publication in August. Ahead of the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, I've written a book that will detail how the staff of the Wall Street Journal responded when its main newsroom, located just across the street from the World Trade Center, was obliterated by falling debris and flaming dust. My book is titled September 12th, An American Comeback Story, and it details the behind-the-scenes tale of the traumatized men and women of the Journal who overcame their personal anguish and confusion to publish a Pulitzer Prize-winning edition of the paper on September 12th. I wrote the book because I believe it reflects the indomitable spirit of America and Americans. As Vince Lombardi once said, the real glory is being knocked to your knees and then coming back. What you're about to hear is the chapter titled, I Don't Want My Life to Be Dust. It's a verbatim reading of the text. I serve as the chapter's narrator, along with a small cast of voice actors. Just to set the stage, without giving away too much about the chapter or the book, on the morning of 9/11, New York-based editors and reporters for the Wall Street Journal found themselves without a place to work. Some retreated 50 miles or so to a pop-up newsroom in South Brunswick, New Jersey. Most of the reporters worked from home, if they could. Remember, back in 2001, the technology required to work remotely was much less sophisticated than it is now. Many of the journalists still relied on AOL or a slow dial-up connection to access the internet. There was no Zoom. When the main Wall Street Journal newsroom was destroyed, its bureaus in cities, including Washington, D.C., Chicago, Boston, Atlanta, and Los Angeles, did what they could to pick up the slack. This chapter focuses on the efforts of the Dallas Bureau and its chief, Karen Blumenthal, to help produce the September 12th edition of the paper. The way the Journal and its staff responded on 9/11 offers many lessons for any organization, business, or individual who is confronted with an unexpected large setback and can either rebound or quit. In the case of the Wall Street Journal, although no one there ever imagined having to publish daily without the use of the paper's main newsroom, the actions that editors took long before 9/11, especially when it came to cementing the can-do culture of the paper, turned out to be lifesavers on September 11th, both figuratively and literally. You'll be hearing more about my book and its lessons for owners and managers in the weeks and months ahead. Meanwhile, if you'd like to share your own 9/11 story, I've set up a form where you can contribute your memories of that day. The recollections I receive will be included on my September 12th book website and may eventually be used in a dedicated book to be published sometime in the future. You'll find the form at tinyurl.com/whereweryouon9/11. That's tinyurl.com/whereweryouon9/11. And be sure to stay tuned at the end of the audio chapter to learn how you can register to purchase a signed first edition copy of my book at no additional cost. Now, Chapter 4, I Don't Want My Life to Be Dust. Good Good Morning Moss Haven was broadcasting the day's weather forecast as Karen Blumenthal looked on. It was 69 degrees Fahrenheit in Dallas at 8 a.m., but temperatures were expected to climb to a high of 84. Blumenthal was standing in the library of her sixth grade daughter's elementary school as the student presenters segued to the Tuesday lunch menu. Chicken, bites, tenders, patties, and nuggets was a staple, as was pizza, cheeseburgers, salad, and of course, mac and cheese. Blumenthal, who had light hazel eyes and chin-length hair parted to the left, always seemed to be smiling. When her cell phone rang, she broke away from the juvenile newscast and a conversation she was having with a friend to take a call from her mother, Beverly. Her mom was practically shouting into the receiver.
Where are you? Turn on the radio. A plane just flew into the World Trade Center.
In her fifth year as Dallas bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, Blumenthal had her doubts.
Surely she is mistaken. Surely she heard something wrong. But I'm not going to argue with her or start rumors in the middle of an elementary school library.
Making her excuses, Blumenthal dashed to her car to catch the adult news on the radio. Her recollections of that day are captured in an unpublished account that she wrote years later. The Dallas Bureau, a 40-minute drive west via I-30 from American Airlines global headquarters in Fort Worth, was a central hub for the journal's worldwide airline industry reporting. Blumenthal knew that coverage of the biggest airline story since Kitty Hawk, four hijacked passenger planes used to devastating effect as lethal missiles, would fall heavily on her shoulders. The timing was less than ideal. The journal's lead aviation and travel reporter, Scott McCartney, who arguably had the best sources of any mainstream reporter on the beat, was attending a conference in Seattle, examining what had been the industry's biggest preoccupation until that morning, air traffic control congestion and the resulting gridlock. McCartney was still asleep in his hotel room when Blumenthal called on her way into the Bureau's downtown office.
Now I was shouting, telling him what happened and some of what we needed to do right away. See what you can find out and keep me posted. I barked, and then quite unprofessionally, I love you.
Blumenthal met McCartney in 1978, her sophomore year at Duke University. A freshman, he walked into the office of The Chronicle, Duke University's independent student newspaper, where she was serving as editor of the paper's weekly magazine. In 1979, the same year that she was promoted to editor-in-chief, they began dating. Abby Blumenthal, the couple's adult daughter, 21 years later recounted her parents' early interactions.
My mom gave my dad his first assignment, and the joke was that it continued for about 40 years.
McCartney showed early promise, despite making spelling and stylistic errors.
Finally, she just hauled off and threw a style book at him, which I guess got his attention.
In return, McCartney, who succeeded Blumenthal as the editor of The Chronicle, snared her heart. The two married in Dallas in August 1983. She was 24, he was 23. McCartney's love and respect for his wife were unbridled. He was raised in the Episcopal Church. She was brought up Jewish. A rabbi and a minister jointly presided at their wedding. Neither McCartney nor Blumenthal saw their interfaith marriage as an obstacle, but she was committed when the time came to raise their two daughters Jewish. As McCartney told a religion writer for the Dallas Morning News, the more time he spent attending temple with his wife and children, the more comfortable he became.
It was my spiritual home. I really thought of myself as Jewish.
As it turned out, however, the religious authorities, even at his Reform congregation, drew the line between feeling Jewish and being Jewish. So McCartney committed to the required 2 years of classes and intense study necessary to convert officially. In the same way that both he and Blumenthal threw themselves into their jobs, McCartney took his Judaism very seriously. In April 2013, just shy of 20 years after he married Blumenthal, McCartney became president of Temple Emmanuel, the oldest and largest Jewish congregation in Dallas. His wife recognized the humor of it.
I still think it's crazy. I never dreamed I would be the wife of a temple president. I'm married to a guy named McCartney.
Journalism couples are pretty common in the profession. Whether they meet in college, the newsroom, or covering the same stories, reporters and editors have been drawn to one another since the marriage of ink and type. Less common, however, was the situation that Blumenthal and McCartney faced. After working several years as a reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Dallas Bureau, Blumenthal had been hired by the Dallas Morning News to be its business editor. McCartney, meanwhile, continued as a Journal staff reporter in its Dallas Bureau. In essence, wife and husband were rivals. To keep the peace, the rule in the Blumenthal-McCartney household was that anything work-related was to remain off-limits for discussion at home. That pact, however, was seriously tested one Saturday in the fall of 1994 when Blumenthal answered their home phone. On the other end of the call was a senior-level corporate source who she knew well. However, the executive was not calling for her, but for her husband. McCartney met with his contact over breakfast the next morning, and Blumenthal could sense that her husband was on to something important.
So I come home with this huge scoop. I get the story done about 10 o'clock at night, and I walk into the living room, and she's sitting there just staring straight ahead, her arms folded. We ended up staying up all night trying to figure this out.
At the office on Monday, McCartney asked Kevin Heliker, then the Journal's Dallas bureau chief, to be assigned a new beat, one that wouldn't put him in competition with his wife. Heliker did McCartney one better. With the encouragement of managing editor Paul E. Steiger, Heliker rehired Blumenthal to the Journal, allowing her to work alongside her husband. Blumenthal was a multi-talented journalist, a great editor, manager, reporter, and a rising star. Lindsay Rupp, a news editor at Bloomberg News, who years later came to know Blumenthal when they both served on the board of the Duke Chronicle Publishing Company, described her friend.
I think the most amazing thing about Karen is that she's this incredible badass. Like, she just was so tough and so sharp and fearless. But she was also somehow incredibly warm, as she was this doting mom and she adored her husband, Scott.
In the spring of 1996, Blumenthal was placed in charge of the Journal's Dallas Bureau. Her province eventually extended to covering 8 states and supervising a dozen reporters, including McCartney. On September 11, with the Journal's New York newsroom rendered unoccupiable and the usual lines of editorial authority frayed, Blumenthal stepped into the void. Outwardly, she appeared calm and in control, as she always did, but her stomach churned with fear, fretting for the safety of her Journal friends in Manhattan who were caught in the epicenter of the attacks. With systems and personnel in Manhattan indisposed, the Dallas Bureau took on additional responsibilities. The Journal's New York and New Jersey engineers, at least those technicians who were available, shifted some critical computer operations to Dallas, along with control of the newsroom's essential email network. Since phone service on the East Coast was spotty at best, the ability of the Journal's dispersed editors and reporters to communicate with one another, coordinate plans, and file stories and memos rested heavily on the email framework. Now stationed in Dallas, the journal's email functioned that day. Sometimes. Other times, the system went down or operated slowly. There would be no incoming messages. Then suddenly, a burst of delayed correspondence would arrive. Complicating matters, reporters by the dozens began to relay their whereabouts, asking how they might help, and expressing their gratitude on hearing that their colleagues were safe. Because so many of the journalists repeatedly hit reply all, the email chain became unwieldy and eventually clogged the entire system. Before Marcus Brockley, the paper's national news editor, was able to situate himself in his Brooklyn Heights home to take charge of that day's SCED, newspaper slang for the list of stories slated to run in the next edition, Blumenthal had taken it upon herself to compile one for Dallas and the domestic bureaus other than Washington, D.C. Deciphering Blumenthal's lineup, it indicated that Gary Putka, the paper's Boston bureau chief since 1993, would orchestrate coverage of how Islamic Americans were reacting, with help from the Chicago bureau, where her former Dallas bureau chief, Kevin Heliker, was now in charge. Joe White, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Detroit bureau chief, and his crew would be responsible for reporting on the corporate reactions to the terrorist attacks. Susan Carey, who was based in Chicago and often collaborated with Scott McCartney when it came to tracking the airline industry, would report on the shutdown of the air traffic system, along with Windy City colleagues Devin Spurgeon and Patricia Callahan. McCartney, who was curating emails from reporters around the country, would write the lead airline article from his hotel roost in Seattle. His story, U.S. airport security screening, long seen as dangerously lax, co-authored with J. Lynn Lunsford in Los Angeles and David Armstrong in Boston, would be the first to correctly theorize what happened aboard the hijacked airliners.
Pilots and airline officials believe it is likely the hijackers disabled or killed both pilots in each of the three planes that struck the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and then flew the planes themselves into the structures.
Scott Kilman, who often wrote about agriculture from Chicago, was recruited to write about the shutdown of the Chicago Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
The closure of the New York exchanges shut down the Chicago futures markets, creating a situation in the Farm Belt not seen since the Chernobyl nuclear plant explosion in April 1986. Nobody knew the price of a bushel of U.S. grain yesterday.
Alexi Barrionuevo, who covered global energy from the journal's Houston Bureau, a part of Blumenthal's domain, would size up the impact on oil prices. In Los Angeles, veteran aerospace aviation reporter Andy Pastor phoned his bureau chief, Jonathan Friedland, at home shortly after 6 a.m. Pacific time to clue him in on the developing story. Friedland was watching CNN when the second plane hit the South Tower. His thoughts immediately turned to how he would harness the bureau staff to help cover the breaking story. Blumenthal's SCED listed the Los Angeles Bureau as responsible for coordinating the paper's coverage of closures of businesses and high-rises across the country. Disney World in Orlando was evacuated. Disneyland in Orange County, California, never opened. The Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco was cleared as a precaution. Even as Blumenthal was meeting out and tracking assignments, one of her reporters ran into her office, gasping.
There's a report that a hijacked plane may be headed here.
The Dallas Bureau was located on the 50th floor of the 56-story Renaissance Tower, the second tallest skyscraper in the city. Soon, every business in the high-rise except the journal would shut down, leaving the hallways dark and the downstairs restaurants shuttered. But Blumenthal and her team didn't consider reporting and organizing coverage from their homes as a viable alternative. So they persevered in place. In the Los Angeles Bureau, Friedland and two of his top reporters, Rebecca Smith, who reported on energy, and John Emschweiler, an expert on white-collar crime, produced the Page 2 story, along with Barrio Nuevo in Houston, Energy Firms Act to Protect Their Systems.
Energy companies that control the nation's electricity and natural gas supplies, as well as big oil companies, went on heightened alert to safeguard the system from possible attack. Across the country, utility emergency control centers came to life, and extra security patrols were initiated. But with thousands of miles of pipelines and transmission lines, it was largely a symbolic effort. With energy markets suspended and trading floors closed in New York and Houston, the biggest impact was financial.
What the public didn't know, and wouldn't learn for more than a month, was that Houston-based Enron was teetering on the verge of collapse. As Friedland recalled, Smith and Emschweiler were hot on the trail of one of the largest corporate cons in American history when they had to temporarily set aside their pursuit to help chronicle the after effects of 9/11.
We were locked and loaded.
Smith and Emschweiler's first Enron story did not run until Wednesday, October 17, 2001, followed by a nearly non-stop series of exposés. Within a month, Enron's stock lost more than 75% of its value. And in early December 2001, the seventh largest Fortune 500 company, with $101 billion in revenue, filed for bankruptcy. Jeffrey K. Skilling, the former Enron chief executive, was eventually convicted of 18 counts of fraud and conspiracy and spent more than 12 years in prison. Kenneth Lay, the company's founder and chairman, was found guilty of 6 counts of fraud and conspiracy and 4 counts of bank fraud. Lay died about a month after his trial in 2006, and his conviction was vacated. Had the September 11 terrorist attacks not occurred, the Journal likely would have broken the Enron story sooner. However, it's debatable whether that would have cushioned the blow to the investors, vendors, and employees who were walloped by Enron's malfeasance. In their 2003 book, 24 Days, the two journalists wrote that the lies Enron told not only destroyed it and the accounting firm Arthur Andersen, but also the lives of thousands of employees and the integrity of American business. Nonetheless, the Enron flimflam paled in comparison to the ruination caused on September 11th. Blumenthal rounded out her sked for the next day's paper with assignments for Atlanta Bureau reporters Rick Brooks, Chris Oster, Carrick Mollenkamp, and Will Pinkston. When McCartney completed his September 12 draft, he sent it on to Blumenthal to edit. It was long by the paper's standards, and McCartney was worried about its verbosity. As she later wrote, Blumenthal was bemused by her husband's concerns, but understood their basis.
The Journal measured its stories in inches, 50 words to the inch, and it was stingy with even the most important breaking news stories. Old-timers used to joke that the second coming of Jesus would have been told in 12 inches, or 600 words.
Blumenthal assured McCartney that on this day, he'd receive a reprieve. She lobbied the editors in New York to feature McCartney's dispatch on the front page, which they did. The exclusive was one of 10 stories the Journal included in its successful nomination package for the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for Breaking News. McCartney, with a ruddy cheek complexion, is a strapping man of Scottish descent who grew up in Boston and in his college days could well have passed for a linebacker with the Duke Blue Devils. His article submitted, and now in the hands of others, he sat in his confined hotel room, littered with food service items which he hadn't allowed housekeeping to collect, and watched as New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani held a news conference.
The number of casualties will be more than any of us can bear, ultimately.
McCartney finally let the day's events sink in. He collapsed on the bed, sobbing. Karen Blumenthal stood only shoulder high to her husband, but she kept her emotions in check on September 11. In mid-afternoon, she phoned her babysitter, who was looking after her and McCartney's 13 and 11-year-old daughters. In her written account years later, Blumenthal shared the conflict she felt between her parenting and news instincts.
More than anything, I wanted to be with my girls, but that would have to wait.
That evening, at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, President Bush addressed the nation from the Oval Office.
Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. The victims were in airplanes or in their offices, secretaries, businessmen and women, military and federal workers, moms and dads, friends and neighbors. Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror. The pictures of airplanes flying into buildings, fires burning, huge structures collapsing, have filled us with disbelief, terrible sadness, and a quiet, unyielding anger. These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat. But they have failed. Our country is strong.
At about the same time President Bush was speaking, Blumenthal finished up at the office, making sure the stories she had overseen were done. Then she headed home.
I was drained and distracted. I thanked our babysitter for staying late and supporting the girls, and went to hug my oldest, Abby. She was grim, but okay. She didn't want to talk just yet.
Blumenthal sat with her youngest daughter, Jennifer, who was ready for bed, but not for sleep.
I don't want to be like that.
Like what, Jen?
Dust. They're dust. All those people. I don't want to end up like that. I don't want my life to be dust.
Blumenthal tried to reassure her daughter. The bureau chief's words that night, retold a decade later in her written memoir, were meant to offer hope in the wake of 9/11. But they could well also have served to comfort Jen, her sister Abby, and their father Scott, when unexpectedly, on May 18, 2020, at age 61, Blumenthal died of a heart attack.
In my awkward adult way, I tried to reassure her. People who were loved and cared for were never dust, I promised. They would always be real and whole to those who knew them and remembered them. It might be hard to understand now, I tried to explain, but as journalists, we would tell and retell their stories so that we would know them for the people they were and not just for how they died. On September 11, 2001, I promised my young daughter that we would not forget, that the lives that were lost that day would never be dust. Even after 10 years, we are still telling their stories and ours. And we will keep telling them to honor and to remember those who died and to try to ensure that we will never have another day like that again.
Register now and be notified when Dean Rothbart's new book, September 12th, Ground Zero on 9/11 with the Wall Street Journal, is available for purchase. When you register today, you'll be notified without any obligation to receive a signed first edition copy of September 12th at no additional cost. Remember, there's no obligation to buy Dean's book, but if you register in advance and then decide to purchase the book, Dean will personally sign your copy and make sure you receive a limited first edition copy. To register, visit tinyurl.com/preregister tinyurl.com/preregister0912-01. That's tinyurl.com/preregister0912-01. On September 11, 2001, the Wall Street Journal's main newsroom, located just across from the World Trade Center, was obliterated by falling debris and flaming smoke. Dean's book is the true story of how the traumatized men and women of the Journal and Dow Jones, journalists, graphic designers, technicians, administrative assistants, compositors, and delivery truck drivers, overcame their personal anguish and confusion to publish a Pulitzer Prize-winning edition on September 12th. Available August 2021 from TJFR Press. Be sure to register today.
You've been listening to Monday Morning Radio with Dean Rothbart. Be sure to read and subscribe to my weekly email column, The Monday Morning Memo, at mondaymorningmemo.com, where I share my observations on the world at large. Trends, tastes, marketing, advertising, small business, whatever else is on my mind. This is Roy H. Williams.
Good luck, all the best, till we hear from you again.